Let's go across the country to Washington, D.C. Congressman Denny Heck represents Washington's 10th District, covering parts of Pierce, Thurston, and Mason counties. He also sits on the House Intelligence Committee, and in a few weeks, he is going to be in the majority. So, Congressman Heck, what changes? You were on CNN last night saying that from what you've seen, there is enough evidence to charge the president with a crime?
Well, we have Michael Cohen, who's going into court today to get his sentence, having pleaded guilty to a crime that the sentencing memo submitted by the prosecutors indicated was directed, he was directed to commit by the president. So, yes.
Where do you come down on the issue of whether a sitting president can be indicted or not?
So, I think it's actually an arguable legal point, and I don't think it is settled. There is sufficient written material in the past to support both sides, although the prevailing point of view now seems to be you cannot indict him. But I think we're going to test that proposition here in the not-too-distant future. I don't think it'll be tested over the Cohen guilty plea for campaign finance reform or campaign finance laws that he broke, which are a felony and which the president has essentially been named an unindicted co-conspirator. It may be tested, however, if the Mueller report is issued and it includes either a smoking gun evidence of conspiring with the Russians to interfere in the 2016 presidential election or obstruction of justice. And I think the special counsel is investigating and pursuing both of those. Although it's important to add, Dave, I don't have eyes on the Mueller investigation per se. He's an independent investigator, and as such, there's a bit of a wall between his work and the work of the House Intelligence Committee.
Well, indictment wouldn't be up to you. It'd be up to him, right?
Correct. I'm just saying, with respect to my assessment that they are still hard at work on finding the smoking gun evidence of conspiring and coordinating with the Russians and or evidence of obstruction of justice, I don't have eyes on his
right.
work in that regard. I'm just piecing together all the clues from the multiple indictments. We should remember we've had 192 criminal charges and 36 indictments or guilty pleas out of all of this, and a lot of paperwork with respect to sentencing memos and filings. And so you gotta have to read them and read between the lines to
right.
get a sense of where he's
going.
Well,
can you boil it down? I mean, ultimately, whatever happens to the president, what people want to know is whether their most powerful government official is somehow in somebody else's pocket, right? Whether somebody else is pulling the strings. So is it your feeling somebody else is pulling the strings? And if that's not the case, then yeah, ultimately, what does what happened in the past matter?
So I think that you've asked precisely the right question as to whether or not somebody is pulling the strings. And it was an avenue of investigation that the majority party over the last couple of years before they terminated the Russian investigation would not allow us to pursue. Incoming Chair Adam Schiff of California has indicated a strong interest in actually examining that very point. With respect to things like why did the Deutsche Bank so willingly loan money to the Trump Organization when no other bank on the face of the planet would? What does that mean? What is the potential entanglement there? And then, of course, tragically, over the last couple of months, we've had raised the issue of are there financial entanglements with Saudi Arabians as a consequence of the president's complete denial of what everybody realizes, which is it's Crown Prince of
right.
Saudi Arabia.
I have to say, of all the things going on, that's probably the strangest thing is the president's reluctance to speak out against Saudi Arabia. But he has explained that essentially, saying that you need Saudi Arabia as a check on Iran, which is an even worse problem. If that turns out to be the case, wouldn't that be a legitimate reason?
So there's no question that in some instances, Saudi Arabia has been a strategic ally with America in the Middle East. But, Dave, can't we just stop, take a step back? They're an ally in pursuit of what? In pursuit of our values. And if they no longer manifest our values, through things like the ordering of the murder of a journalist, and frankly, the potential committing of war crimes in their efforts in the Yemen civil war, then how is it that they can be an ally? They're an ally of ours. Why? Alliances are based on shared values, mutual self-interest, but also shared values. These are not our values. We don't murder journalists in America, and we certainly don't drop bombs on wedding parties, as has occurred on more than one occasion in Yemen.
Well, we have by mistake, of course. That happened in Afghanistan, yeah. Did it not?
Fool me once.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a repeated thing. It's the civil war in Yemen's triggered one of the great humanitarian crises in modern history. And unfortunately, I fear that our sale of arms and our support of Saudi Arabia in this regard makes us complicit in that. And I find that unacceptable.
Congressman Denny Heck, 10th District. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Dave.
With Jackson Timbers, they started back down. Then came that rumble way down in the ground. And the smoke and gas belched out of that mine. Everybody knew it was the end of the line for Big John.
Big John.
Felix Bunnell, our resident historian, brought to us by the King County Library System. Also, our resident playwright. I think we're probably the only talk station with its own resident playwright. And last night's performance will be online. At some point, or is it online?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it'll be on. It's going to replay over the Christmas holiday, too, and there'll be a video version of it on the Seattle Channel website in about 10 days, too. So it was thoroughly documented.
Wait. There were cameras there?
Remember that piece of paper you signed on that clipboard? I'm not making this up. Yeah, that was a video release. So you'll see it all.
Oh,
it's all
great.
Theater of the Mindless. Theater of the Mind, excuse me.
I should try reading those things I sign once in a while.
Nah, it's okay. I had your back, Dave. Don't worry.
Washington has a long history of coal mining stretching back into the 19th century. We also have a history of mining accidents, including the Carbonado disaster of December 1899. Felix is brought to us by the King County Library System. What happened?
Well, you know, the Puget Sound, most of the state is regarded historically as timber country because the timber industry continues to this day, right? It's much smaller than it was, but the history of coal mining around here is mostly forgotten. And a few weeks ago, I came across a staggering statistic. This is from my Pierce County and aviation history expert, Lee Corbin. This is from 1892 to 1929, 961 lives were lost in coal mines in Washington. That's almost 1,000 people over a 37-year period. That shocked me, that number. And one of the worst accidents in terms of loss of life was 119 years ago this week. It was December 9th, 1899. This was down in Carbonado, eastern Pierce County, along the Carbon River, where mining began back around 1881. Coal was prized by the railroads mainly, and a lot of the coal found here was shipped out to California. But I tracked down a delightful historian named John Streepy. He wrote his master's thesis on mining in Carbonado about 20 years ago. He lives in Sammamish, but he has deep personal ties. His grandparents moved to Carbonado in the 1920s, and his dad was raised there. I asked John Streepy to tell me what happened in Carbonado back in 1899, December 9th, around 11 in the morning.
Gas ignites, immediate explosion. Felt throughout the entire mine. All the levels felt it. And where it happened, these were the frontline miners. These were the most experienced, the best miners. So in an instant, immediately, you know, they just lost their best.
There were 73 men working in the mine when the blast hit that Saturday morning. I asked John to paint a picture of what was going on outside the mine in the immediate aftermath.
You know, they're pulling bodies out. There's men being held back from, you know, going in. So there's a crowd around down at the mine level and people waiting at the top of the incline for any news that are coming out. It's the kind of thing that, you know, initially it's so deep, people at the town level didn't know. And then people rushed to the site to find out what had happened to their loved ones because everybody knew everybody.
Yeah, and John says that not only did everybody know each other, but there were often multiple generations of the same family at work in the mine at the same time. He told me one particularly sad story about a man named Howell Meredith, who was in the upper reaches of the mine when the blast hit.
He knew his boys were down low. He wasn't a supervisor or a foreman or anything, so he didn't have anybody he had to worry about, and he went down the shafts to try to find his sons. He ends up dying ironically, his sons had already gotten out.
Yeah, so it was actually pretty chaotic. So Washington actually had a mine safety program in those days, and the carbonate of mine had fans to generate air pressure and prevent the buildup of methane and other explosive gas, and the mine was tested before the morning shift that day. But John says coal mines here in Washington, because of our volcanic activity, tend to be gassier and more dangerous than places like Kentucky or West Virginia. So State Mine Inspector A.C. Little and Governor John Rogers arrived in Carbonado late on the day of the explosion to begin an investigation. The likely cause was determined fairly quickly. A pocket of methane, you know, invisible and odorless gas, must have been opened somewhere in the mine after the shift began. And then a miner named Ben Zedler did something he shouldn't have.
It happened because some guy went into the mine with a pipe and tobacco.
Oh.
And halfway through his shift, he thought he'd opened up his lamp and light his pipe, have a nice little smoke in the middle of his shift. And obviously, he had must have done this before. It's not easy to just open up a mining lamp. So he, you know, must have had some experience doing it.
Wow.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's no monument in Carbonado, but there's plenty of headstones in the graveyard. There's 23 victims buried in a single area, and that was on December 12th, 1899. And, you know, coal was used by the railroad a lot, and then when the railroad switched to oil, the coal industry around here pretty much shut down by the mid-1930s, pre-World War II. So it's almost like it never happened unless you take the time to dig a little deeper.
Wow. Felix Bunnell, resident historian, brought to you by the King County Library System. All Felix's features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thank you, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. It is time for another edition of
Something Else to Worry About.
Because it isn't enough that scalpers will jump on all the best concert tickets before they go on sale to the general public. Now, scalpers, or as they're being called, Grinch bots, are buying out almost the entire supply of popular toys and then reselling them at vastly higher prices. Consumer Reports is all over this, and Chuck Bell is their advocacy director. Tell me how these Grinch bots work, Chuck.
Essentially, these are automated software tools that are used to fill out order forms on retailer websites. And as it turns out, they're able to operate much more quickly than an individual consumer could. And so the concern is that with the increasing use of cyber bots by third parties, that it's driving up prices and making toys more scarce at holiday time for consumers.
So they're actually buying up popular toys and having them shipped where?
Well, they tend to have them shipped to their own addresses, and then they resell them on third-party websites.
Oh, I see.
Such as eBay and Amazon.
But they place all these orders electronically. And I thought a lot of these websites, there's always a check mark that says, I am not a robot, or, you know, tell me which pictures have the traffic light to avoid this.
That's true, but cyberbot tools could have automated systems that can defeat those I am not a robot and capture features at a website. And once they get to the order form, they're able to fill it out lightning fast. So with ticket scalping, we had an example here in New York where tickets sold out for a U2 concert and with more than 1,000 orders per minute based on cyberbot orders. And that's a similar principle for retailers and toys. And also, these cyberbots troll the retailer websites and find the individual product pages, and they are just able to submit orders much more quickly than individual consumers could.
That's crazy. Can't the artificially intelligent software that we have today detect when you're getting 1,000 orders from the same address within a certain period of time and say, no, you can't do that?
Yes, there are certain software tools that are available from security companies to help retailers address the cyberbot problem, and it's similar to what has been required nationally for to prevent ticket scalping. And so Senators Udall, Blumenthal, and Schumer have introduced a bill, the Stopping Grinch Bots Act of 2018, to help block the cyberbots, mm-hmm. Similar to what we do for ticket sales. Unfortunately, it's not likely to pass in December to help out this year. But it is pending in Congress, and we hope we'll see some action on it shortly.
Any opposition to it?
I don't think there's been a lot of opposition. I mean, I think the primary concern from retailers is this can be a costly proposition to adopt all the technological measures to fend off the cyber bots. So it's a complicated problem, and there really probably aren't magic bullet solutions for it. As long as you have third parties that are out there trying to, you know, create a secondary market to speculate in the price of toys, unfortunately, that's going to leave some parents and kids disappointed. And I think we want to protect toys for their use value by kids rather than creating like an investment proposition for third parties that want to enrich themselves.
I know, this has always happened one way or another, right? I remember the Beanie Baby craze and the Cabbage Patch Kids craze. I mean, they've been trying to do this. Scalpers always try to operate regardless of the technology. Which particular toys are being targeted this year? Do you know?
Well, actually, it's a little early in the season. You know, last year we saw a number of toys, particularly like gaming systems like Super Nintendo, was selling for as much as $13,000 on Amazon and eBay after it went out of stock. Ordinarily, it was retailing for $80. And we saw the Fingerlings last year. The Fingerling doll was being resold on Amazon and eBay for as much as $1,000 each.
That's crazy. Of course, the other thing you can do is say, no, I'm not going to pay that.
That's absolutely true. I mean, you will often find that if you can wait a few weeks that the prices are likely to come down or that the retailer will have more inventory. So the scammers are really relying on the fact that you feel incented to buy the toy this week. Certainly don't get drawn into a bidding war where you're paying thousands of dollars for a $15 stuffed doll.
I'm curious, is there any research indicating that if you do not buy your child a baby shark when he or she wants it, that they grow up hating you forever?
I'm not aware of any research that says that. And actually, you know, it's an interesting lesson about our marketplace. You know, as children are growing up, we need to teach them to be somewhat skeptical of all the marketing and advertising that they see. And it's, in a sense, it's a teachable moment that the bad guys have come in and driven up the price of that shark to $800. You know, you can take a pause and you'll probably get one in a month if you can just be a little patient.
Chuck Bell from Consumer Reports. Thanks, Chuck. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Your daily dose of kindness now. It's brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. It turns out you can learn a lot from a sixth grader about honesty. CBS's Steve Hartman found proof.
In Buffalo, New York, Canisius College senior Andrew Sipowicz has a tale to tell that is truly unique. A heartwarming story about a hit and run. Yeah, he says it all began the day he discovered the dent in his Ford Mustang.
It was bashing him pretty good.
And then you saw the note.
Then I saw the note. I wasn't expecting that at all. That it came from a sixth grader.
Obviously, 11-year-old Zaira Griffin didn't make the dent. But she did make it better with the note she tucked under his windshield. It read, "If you're wondering what happened to your car, bus 449 hit your car. It stops here every day to drop me off. She hit and run. Sorry." Zaira closed with a sketch of the getaway vehicle. As a result of her artistry and honesty, the bus driver was held accountable, and Andrew is now getting his car fixed.
I couldn't act like it didn't happen, but I chose to do something about it. Because my mom always said, when you see somebody doing the wrong thing, you have to do the right thing.
But her mom, Takara, refuses to take all the credit. In fact, Takara admits she wasn't exactly supportive when her daughter started going all Dudley Do-Right that day.
You're thinking, I want to get out of here.
Yes. I don't want anyone to think it was me.
I think that's why sometimes people don't say anything, because it's easier to just walk away.
My daughter taught me how to stay kind, stay compassionate, always knowing the right thing is always the right thing.
Hi.
Andrew says Zaira taught him that as well.
I'm Andrew.
Which is why he just had to meet her.
I couldn't believe you left me that note. When I first saw my car, I was angry, and then I saw your note, and it changed my entire mood. To know that there's people out there with the type of integrity and honesty, it's something I'm going to remember for the rest of my life. So,
yeah.
Again, her mom credits nature over nurture, but she is clearly doing something right.
Very grateful.
Because raising kids who stand up to injustice.
Thank you guys so much.
Is no accident.
You're welcome.
That's CBS's Steve Hartman.
Anything that makes people less angry, I'm all in favor of. Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is from 710 ESPN Seattle, the man who originated the role of Old Jack, the unshowered recluse hermit who hangs around
was laid off, shops. Laid off by the frozen pea plant.
Danny O'Neill. Be sure, if you do nothing else in the next 24 hours, download his performance at MyNorthWest.com of A Very Cairo Christmas, and you'll be amazed because it's nothing like the snappy dresser you are in real life. I mean, it was an acting stretch for you.
But I'll say this. I just screamed a lot, which is very much in character.
That part was true. The curmudgeon part?
Yeah.
That was
just
absolutely
yelling,
on point.
Hollering at folks.
You know, Felix says that he imagined that play is sort of like The Wizard of Oz, where all the people who play, you know, their real-life roles at Cairo play similar roles in this little fictitious world he created.
Is that why Sully kept saying choke point?
That's right, yes.
Yes, it is.
Even crazier is that all 600 people in the crowd got it.
That was awesome.
That was.
It got multiple laughs. And then when you gave about the closing down the three-lane highway to open up the toll bridge on a two-lane tunnel.
Stop the show.
Stop the show. We got to thank Felix for that.
Yeah. Felix is awesome.
Yes, he is. Yeah. It was amazing.
So the Mariners are going to be playing at the stadium formerly known as Safeco for the next 25 years. But now this is my question, because there was a big discussion over this lease, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how they were going to get less money from the county than they wanted.
Correct.
Is this why they're selling off all their stars?
No.
Okay.
It's unrelated. It better be unrelated. No, I don't. It doesn't have any. The reason they're trading away their top on field players is those are baseball reasons. There was a debate and discussion. And I think it's a fair one about the Mariners and characterizing themselves as tenants and their negotiations with what is the county board. And they come to a compromise where I think it's less money than they were initially planning, but they've got a 25-year lease here. So it's for a sports team, they certainly wanted to be able to plan with specifics and felt that they should get terms similar to what they'd gotten before. The politics for getting a stadium have changed significantly since Safeco was built, or since the park formerly known as Safeco was built. And you saw it get lobbed into, don't we have more important things to be spending this on?
Mm-hmm. And so we have a home for the Mariners.
Correct, 25 years.
But we have a very uncertain team. But manager Scott Service, it sounds like when he was at the winter meetings, he says, yeah, we're rebuilding and I'm ready to take on that challenge.
You better be ready for it.
Yeah. Is he the type of manager who can?
I think so. His background in player development and the work that he's done in the scouting, because this is his first on-field manager role, he's going to be more of a teacher. You're going to have more young guys. So you're going to see that is a different role for a manager. I do think he's well-suited for that. The question is, does he survive the rebuilding process?
Does that not often happen?
No.
Oh.
Because you're talking about losing for a couple years in a row. And managers tend to become sacrificial lambs. If nothing else, you're like, okay, we've had enough. Losing puts a strain on everybody in a franchise, even when you're losing, not on purpose, but you're understanding that losses are going to come. Do you survive to see the other side of it?
You'd think that as they're losing and rebuilding, they'd want stability, which if they believe in their current manager, they would keep that current man. It just seems counterintuitive to shake it up at the management.
But sometimes
level
Moses doesn't get to go to the promised land.
Well, there's just that losing strains everybody in an organization.
But knowing that going into rebuild, why the knee-jerk reaction?
Well, it's not, and I'm not saying that that's definitely going to happen.
Right.
It tends to be the result, is that two or three years of losses, teams generally tend to fire a manager. So we'll see if he sees it to the other side. I hope he does. I think he's a really good baseball guy, and I do think he could be a real big asset to the rebuilding process.
Lou Piniella misses the Hall of Fame by a vote. Edgar, is this his last chance?
It's his last chance on the regular baseball writer's ballot. There is still, and Lou Piniella was being considered by the Veterans Committee. It's composed of, I think it was 20 people, and you needed 12 votes to get in. Maybe it was 16 people, and you needed 12 votes, and he came up one short. Mm-hmm. Which was lame, especially because they let in a couple of nice guys who are relatively mediocre.
Yeah. And what about Edgar?
Edgar's going to get in.
He will.
Yeah, I've seen 33 ballots, and I think he's been named on all but two of them. But he's picked up five ballots that did not name him last year that named him this year. He's going to get in this year.
Excellent, because he deserves it.
He does.
Danny O'Neill, our Sports Insider, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers.
Thank you, Pop. Thank you for your kindness.
It's okay, young man.
Off you go.
Hundreds of additional treatment beds for those with mental illness. Investments in existing and new state hospitals and a new teaching hospital. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott says this is all part of the governor's $675 million proposal for the state's mental health care system. Here's Hannah Scott.
Governor Inslee says these new investments will help transform Washington State's mental health care system.
And the reason is we know that mental health needs touch every family ultimately in the state of Washington. And we know that great things can happen to these families and these people when they get the care they need in circumstances that meet their needs and when they get it in a timely fashion.
And getting care in a timely fashion has been a major issue at state hospitals, especially Western State. In 2014, the state Supreme Court found Washington was unconstitutionally leaving patients in places like emergency rooms where they did not get proper treatment because of the lack of bed space. And in a separate class action lawsuit recently settled by the state, known as the Trueblood case, the state agreed to make major changes to deal with inmates with mental health issues that were left lingering in jails as they waited for competency services. Western State has also been plagued with staff shortages, safety issues, and long waits for incoming and outgoing patients.
We have people who are ready to discharge from Western and Eastern State Hospital who are ready to get back to their communities. They've had a good result. They're doing a lot better. But there's no place for them to go to have any sort of supported housing. So we have this huge blockage in the system. And as a result for that, we can't get people into our state hospitals. And a result of that, we have people languishing in our county and city jails who can't get into our state hospitals. We need to unplug this system.
The governor says his proposal will address all of that. Among other things, it invests more than $56 million for improvements at Western and Eastern state hospitals to help reduce the risk of patients harming themselves or others. The plan also begins investing in design for a new 500-bed state hospital, with construction starting in 2023. Inslee's plan would also begin investing in his five-year vision to move civil commitment patients out of state hospitals.
We want to provide mental health care system closer to where people live, in their communities, places that are closer to their places of work, to their friends, to their family, to their churches, rather than just large institutions. And we plan to do that by opening a number of state-operated, mostly, centers.
This proposal veers away from his original vision, which was for multiple 16-bed state-run facilities spread out across the state for civil patients. Under this plan, which is still similar, there would be 9 state-run facilities, 4 with 16 beds, 2 with 48, and 3 with 150 beds. Locations would be decided later, and Inslee acknowledged there would still need to be community discussions ahead of time to make sure that locals were okay with having those facilities in their backyards. One of the major issues has been a shortage of psychiatrists and other trained staff. Inslee's proposal calls for a variety of investments to deal with that.
We have a critical shortage of people in the mental health care provision system, and I'm excited about the new creative ideas that we've come up with to provide scholarships with people, to get them to come into the mental health care system earlier. We're going to get talent, and we're going to keep them. And when they come out, we're going to make sure they work for the state of Washington.
And Hannah Scott joins us live now. Hannah, does this mean the day is coming where if somebody is on the street, homeless or whatever, with mental illness, they can be promptly sent into a place that can provide them treatment and get them off the street?
Well, certainly if all of this comes to fruition, and this, you know, remember that lawmakers, the legislature is going to have to okay this $675 million ask that the governor is putting in his budget proposal. But if that happens, yeah, that's the sense, is that this would, over the next several years, transform our state's mental health care system to make sure that there aren't these big backlogs and these bottlenecks both coming in and out of these state hospitals. And that when, and this is, we're talking about community-based facilities that would cover everything from, you know, substance abuse issues to, schizophrenia, various other criminal, mental illness type situations on all levels. So that would be the ultimate goal. I think more needs to be done. Some of these investments here are just starting with the design, like the new state hospital, 500-bed facility. There's just some money in here to start the design process. Money for actually building that would have to come at a later budget, I believe.
All right, it's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. You've heard about proposals for a Medicare for All bill, which would fully replace your health insurance. The question is, can the United States afford such a thing?
Robert Pollan is an economist. He is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and also the founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute. And professor, you did an economic analysis of this type of health plan, correct?
Yes, with co-authors, I did.
One of the things that Bernie Sanders was trying to convince people is that, in fact, a Medicare for All plan would not bankrupt the country. So you've done the calculation. How much would it cost per year to provide this kind of medical insurance to everybody?
What we pay now is about $3.24 trillion. Under Medicare for All, first of all, we cover everybody. So everybody gets covered, and there are no cost sharing, so people don't have to pay deductibles. They don't have to pay out of pocket. There's no co-payments. So even allowing for all that, we estimate that under Medicare for All, the entire system will cost $2.93 trillion. We save over $300 billion a year by transitioning to Medicare for All.
And this would mean that this covers you completely. So you wouldn't have any additional premiums, no supplemental plans, no Medicare Advantage plan, nothing like that?
That's right. It would cover everybody the same way that basic Medicare covers everybody now, for everybody who's over 65. So, yes, there would be no premiums, no copays, no deductibles. Everybody would be covered, and we would still save about 10% relative to what we are currently paying for health care in the United States today.
But in exchange for not having to pay any private insurance premiums, I assume there'd have to be a tax increase of some kind, right?
Yes. So instead of paying into private health care for premiums, we would pay into the U.S. government Medicare system. So what we propose is that the employers would still pay in. They would still pay premiums. We say all businesses, at least for the first years of the system, whatever they're paying now in premiums, they all pay 8% less. So if a business is paying $100 now for its workers, the day Medicare for All starts, you pay $92. And we designed it that way explicitly to make clear the fact that Medicare for All will entail cost savings.
So built into this mechanism is a guaranteed lower payments for businesses. So they're paying 8% less than they are now in private insurance premiums.
Right. Now, of course, it does get a little more complicated because a lot of businesses right now don't cover their workers at all. So over time, we want to transition into something that levels the playing field.
Okay. That still leaves a revenue gap, though. So you have individual taxes on individual payers.
That's right.
That fill in the gap. So what are those other taxes then?
So what we have in addition to raise roughly the other $400 billion are three additional measures. One is a sales tax at 3.75% on non-necessities. So necessities, food, housing would not be taxed.
And then, that, I presume, would be in addition to any state sales taxes that currently exist.
Yes, right? That okay. would be on top of existing state sales taxes.
Right.
And then we have a net worth tax, a wealth tax, that would only apply to roughly the richest 10% of people. And then finally, we propose that the treatment of long-term capital gains in the tax system be treated equal to the way we treat short-term capital gains now. So when you combine those three additional measures, you get the remaining roughly $400 billion, and that finances the whole system.
So beyond those taxes, no change in the federal income tax rates for people?
No, we don't touch the federal income tax rates.
And the type of health care we'd get would not be what you see in Europe, which is frequently large wards with more than one or two or three patients in them and sort of very industrial-looking buildings. We'd still have an American standard of health care with birthing centers, you know, and suites and all the rest of this stuff?
Yes. We haven't suggested any change at all with respect to the hospitals and what they look like. or in fact, we, you know, it's enshrined in the bill, and we demonstrate that it's perfectly possible that people keep their same providers. There's no reason to that anyone would have to change their doctors.
So doctors don't go on the federal payroll or anything. This is just the federal government paying for your own choice of doctor and hospital.
That's right. So the doctors, instead of sending bills to, you know, 23 different insurance companies that have different rules and they get challenged, they're dealing with only one insurance company, the Medicare for All system.
And you wouldn't have long waits for elective surgery like you hear about in Canada and the UK?
There's no reason why we would have to have any long waits, because we are, you know, the doctors on balance are going to make roughly the same amount that they're making now. And
but you would have many more people, though, trying to take advantage of that level of health care, wouldn't you? Because everybody would have insurance now. Nobody gets turned away.
Yeah. So here's what happens. So the doctors and staff, because they are spending, the doctors are spending about 8% of their week on administration. That's going to go down dramatically. So that frees them up more time treating patients. The staff, the nursing staff, is spending even a higher proportion of their overall time on administration. So actually, they will have a lot more time.
So the only people who suffer are those who would be doing paperwork, and they will just have to find other jobs.
Yes, and we do take that seriously. Mm-hmm. Any advocate of Medicare for All, which includes myself, we need to talk about a just transition for all of the administrative workers who will face displacement. So we have a very generous program that includes protection of their pensions. Second of all, 100% wage insurance for 2.5 years if you're near retirement, 1 year if you're younger, and retraining and relocation support. And that's what it takes to get people into new jobs.
But the question you're going to get is, show me a single government program that lives up to hype like this, right?
Oh, well, Medicare. There we go. Medicare okay. For older people.
But, I mean, Medicare gets gamed. We hear reports about that all the time. People have gone to jail for fraud against the Medicare system.
Well, look, there's no perfect system. And, of course, Medicare is imperfect. And so are all the systems in, you know, Canada, the UK, Germany. You know, they're having a lot of fights over restructuring the UK system now. So, of course, no system is perfect. But on balance, if you look at, you know, again, polling evidence, people are highly satisfied in the U.S. with Medicare and have been since it was inaugurated in 1965.
Robert Pollan, economist who teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He presented that paper, by the way, to the Sanders Institute, which was founded by the Bernie Sanders family.